This audio contains strong language.
It's worth pointing out as we begin that 500 years ago, epithets like the dreaded F-word, C-word and the rest were not as unspeakable as they are today. Remember Chaucer's Miller's Tale? Our ancestors were far more easygoing than we are about so-called foul language. Way back in ancient Rome, the poet Catullus was dishing out invective for popular consumption, parts of which have been deemed unsuitable in 1991 for broadcast on good old Radio 4. And apart from its endemic entertainment value, verbal abuse had a respectable place in ancient society. In both Greece and Rome, learning how to insult your opponents was part of formal rhetoric, the art of persuasive speaking. There were handbooks which laid out the best lines of attack. You could get at someone by insulting their ancestors, their military record, or, above all, their sexual habits. Not very different, in fact, from the way the tabloid so-called newspapers operate today, although done with rather more intelligence and style. Richard Hunter is a lecturer in classics at the University of Cambridge.
There were handbooks that people read and wrote, and these handbooks told you both how to say nice things about people and also how to say nasty things about people. I think it's always important to remember that in a law court speech or when you were addressing the assembly in Athens or something, you weren't particularly interested in the truth, you were simply interested in persuading people. And if you could suggest that your opponent had all kinds of unpleasant sexual habits, you weren't particularly interested in the sexual habits per se, but you were interested in what those sexual habits might suggest about them in the rest of their life. That, for example, they weren't a fit political leader, or that they very clearly did steal your money because the sort of person who would do this in bed is the sort of person who would take your money.
As soon as he was past boyhood, he settled down in the Piraeus at the establishment of Euthydius, the physician, pretending to be a student of medicine, but in fact deliberately offering himself for sale, as the event proved. The names of the merchants or other foreigners or of our own citizens who enjoyed the person of Timarchus in those days I will pass over willingly, that no one may say that I am over particular to state every petty detail. But in whose houses he has lived to the shame of his own body and of the city, earning wages by precisely that thing which the law forbids, under penalty of losing the privilege of public speech. Of this I will speak.
There's a handbook of rhetoric here from the 4th century BC, which says that you should use irony and avoid scoffing at the person you're insulting. Well, some of the stuff that that we've got is very direct. I mean, how did this all fit together?
Yeah, there's two kinds of traditions. One is a tradition which is an educated culture tradition, which discusses how you insult people in a kind of theoretical way. And that tradition constantly distinguishes between what you might call cultivated insult, in which you don't actually call a spade, but you rely upon irony, innuendo, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, know what I mean. Whereas there's another kind of insult, which is the calling a spade, the use, for example, of the equivalent of what we would call four-letter words, which is thought to be below the wit of the urbane man. Of course, when it actually comes down to it, those two different types of abuse tend to get mixed up, and you know, and practice is never really quite like theory.
What do you want, woman best fit for black elephants? Why do you send me gifts? Why letters? I, who am no firm youth, nor of unrefined nostril. Indeed, I alone can sniff out more sagely whether an octopus or a heavy goat lurks in hairy armpits than can a keen dog sniff out where the boar hides. What a sweat on her shriveled limbs, and what a bad smell grows everywhere when, after my cock is limp, she hurries to quiet her unconquered lust. Nor does her wet powder stick now, a blush painted on with crocodile dung. Now, being in heat, she breaks the taut bed and the covers.
A little ancient misogyny from the poet Horace, 1st century BC. I think if Horace had been alive today, he'd have been in a heavy metal band. Unpleasant sex and body smells appear to be the main preoccupation of poets of this era, and their womenfolk were not always exactly eulogised.
One of the interesting and I suppose mildly depressing things about ancient abusive poetry is that a lot of the themes and motifs in it just continue and continue. I mean, as long as you read ancient abusive poetry, there are smelly armpits. There's a particular horror is expressed in abusive poetry of oral sex. The notion of the unclean mouth crops up time and time again.
I thought, so help me gods, it made no difference whether I smelt Emilius's mouth or arsehole, one being no cleaner, the other no filthier. But in fact, the arsehole's cleaner and kinder. It has no teeth. The mouth has teeth half a yard long and gums like an ancient wagon chassis.
A poem by Catullus from northern Italy, mid-first century BC. If you think that's nasty, the next part of the poem is currently deemed too risque even to be broadcast on public radio. People certainly seem to have become easier to offend as the years have rolled by. In the street culture of ancient Greece and Rome, the art of insult also flourished, according to Richard Hunter. Surviving rock carvings and graffiti from places like Pompeii include obscenities rivaling anything you'd find scrawled on a wall in a public toilet today. And hurling verbal abuse seems to have been the ancients' idea of a good time, not just in earnest at their enemies, but also as an elaborate game, as part of festivals and ceremonies.
We know of certain types of festival where abuse played a part. For example, we know that in the great procession that went from Athens each year, the initiatory procession to Eleusis for the rites of the Earth Mother, Demeter, that there was a part of the procession where the participants were subjected to abuse. We know that scoffing and jesting was a standard part of Greek weddings. There's quite a lot of literary representations of a stage of the wedding where the bride and groom would have been shut in together, and the guests or a chorus or whatever would stand outside the wedding chamber and, you know, make jokes about the size of the groom's equipment and so forth.
And thus we see that the ancient Mediterranean was the cradle of one of the great pastimes of civilised Western society, the art of verbal abuse.